Al had said earlier, you know, what to what am I called? And I think I, you know, if I try to say in my own life, and it's no, not so much that this is an example as just the evolution that each one of us can track in our lives. You know, you see something and you make you take a certain step. And you know, 3 years ago I started this little center out of my home, out of our home. And my dream is, if we live in a house, you know, in suburban Washington. It's a little house on a street. You know, like thousands of them you'd see anywhere in this country. But my dream is that again, I keep saying that, trying to make that point of modeling something alternative. And I keep saying, how could it be that as people go past this house, they would say, something else is going on there. They live differently. Something's happening. And so I feel very challenged by that, and it's just a dream of mine. If someone would underwrite me for 6 months, we have solar hot water heater, one little thing that we were able to do a few years ago. So from May to October, we have water heated by the sun. And every time I shower, I think, you know, by damn, we beat the system. This is one little thing. And, you know, we have garden and composting in the backyard, and we feed the birds. And I've just, the World Wildlife Fund, you can write to them and ask what you can do in your backyard to be declared a national habitat, a wildlife habitat. And if you have certain, like if you have some trees and hedges, and if you have water or would put out water or something, you can be that. You can encourage the wildlife in your own backyard. And the other dream I have is that there's a whole, there's a school or a movement that talks about edible landscaping. You know, that as you walk out your front door, you're in your this idea, this myth that everyone has to have a green lawn is a myth. It's a mythology. And we reinforce it in one another by kind of expecting. But that I know this man is head of the biology department at the University of Wisconsin. He has all different kinds of greens on his lawn. Some of them are edible. None of it has to be mowed, and it's green and it's delicious and it's beautiful, you know. It's kind of a school of thought called permaculture, that you have zones of culture that you nurture, and as you walk out your door, you're in different zones. You have your herb zone and your, you know, fresh vegetable zone without fertilizers and pesticides, and mm-hmm. and you know that we live more consciously in where we are. And so that's just a little dream for me and around my house. But what our home, and I know, you know, we have the luxury of a house with a lawn, with some grounds around it, and that's sheer luxury. I know that, but for the time being, that's where I am. And I, like tomorrow, I have to. I mean, I can't wait till the perfect moment. You know, it has to be where I am and where we are. And then I say, if we're faithful to the moment, the door will open to lead us to the next step. I think that's, you know, we can say that in our own lives, we hear things, you think, oh, I can't take in one more thing, you know, but what we can call one another to is the next step, whatever that might be. And I think it's fair to say that our faith, our religious journeying demonstrates that if we're faithful to the moment, the next moment will reveal itself. We can't know it until we take that for the next step. So, you know, for me, for any of us. But what also gives me a lot of encouragement is that dream of, you know, living more closely is really a very active movement on the whole North American continent. It's called the bioregional movement. Bioregional. And it is communities of people across this country living consciously within a bioregion. And by bioregion, well, first of all, it would say if we look at the Earth, you know, as we see that Earth from space, or the Earth has its own contours. It has its own watersheds and mountains and deserts and forests, and it isn't just, you know, a smudge of everything the same. It has it, and for thousands of years, peoples lived within given bioregions. Peoples and animals and plants, and they were specific to areas, nurtured, and there was sustenance for the community within a bioregion. So as is a growing kind of sense of how humans have become so alienated from our Earth, the in a way the bioregional movement is a concrete expression of people who are trying to address that. And just, you know, as a sample, and you can look at this more carefully, a very rough map has been done of the United States with the bioregions within our own country. Kind of here we're up in the Columbia River or the Cascade Mountain bioregion. And again, this is a little bit arbitrary. It's just been done by a group of people, but it demonstrates that, you know, even within the United States, the Ozarks are different from the Great Plains, from the Northern Plains, from the Great Lake regions, from the Hudson River Valley. I live in the Chesapeake Bay, or we also, it's the Potomac River Valley bioregion. But each one of those historically had its own, dictated a life, an expression, plant, animal, human, that reflected that bioregion. And so today, like, you know, I personally, or you know, that to try and live that way, but then even to join that movement and try to advance it, to my mind, it rings true with what we're trying to say about coming home to our planet, coming home to this Earth that we call. And, you know, we as a species live for thousands of years very, very defined within a natural bioregion. And many of you see the Race to Save the Planet, the series that started on public television now in the environment?
A few of you saw.
Anyhow, I think it was the opening one. It was the Bush people in the Kalahari Desert. And you look at the way of life of those people, and it's hard to believe that we're on the same planet, even. Mm-hmm. And yet, the way they sustained their lives from the roots, plants of the area, they knew which ones carried water in the veins of the plants, attuneness to the region within which they lived. And if you say, well, they're there, and the people and the Eskimos in another part, surely our lives are, as a human species, are defined and colored and shaped by the Earth that we come to know. And yet in our modern kind of industrial society, we have just sort of lifted ourselves up from that and kind of live in this artificial bubble world that is not rooted in the Earth. I saw, not so long ago, I saw a study done by the World Bank, and they had painted the city of New York red. And then they went all over the globe and painted red wherever New York drew its resources. And the globe was red. I mean, in New York, any city, San Francisco, wherever, any major city, Buenos Aires, Nairobi, anywhere in the world, the city lives off the rest of the universe, off the rest of the planet. And in the rich countries of the world, you know, we reach, our tentacles go all around the globe to make it life possible in a major city. We do not live within the natural confines of the bioregions of which we are a part. And really one of the tenets of the bioregional movement is really to come home, to come as close, to live as close to home as we possibly can. Not totally self-sustaining at all, but relatively, and the burden would fall on trying to be sustainable within that, our own bioregions. So in kind of the theory about bioregion, I'll say it a little bit quickly. I don't want to, you know, I mean, this is sort of a, I mean, if it's helpful, but there are like characteristics that we would say of any bioregion. You know, what do you mean by that? An identifiable geographical area of interacting life systems that are relatively self-sustaining in the, you know, in the unfolding processes of nature. Relatively self-sustaining, these life systems within this a certain region, and we call that a bioregion. Bio, the life of the whole, the total life of the region, not just the human, the total life. And if we look at any of the at bioregions, what we can expect from them or would find is that any bioregion is self-propagating. It has within the contours of that bioregion the needed resources to propagate the life forms that are native to it, plant and animal life. Therefore, when we, when we come in and kind of force every other life form out, we are undermining the very basis of our own bioregion. You know, I think so often, like we pave our roads, we make these immense wide strips, and the small animals don't have a chance to get across those without being killed. But we never think that earth isn't just for us. It belongs to, in the East, I don't know about here in the West, but it used to be, separating the highways, we would have a kind of steel barriers with openings. So the squirrels or the possums or the raccoons would have a chance to get across the road. But lately, more and more, putting up these big cement barriers down the middle. And they're death traps for the small animals. Well, what is that except an anthropocentrism, a hubris about the human agenda that does not allow anything for the other animal life that also shares that bioregion? And a bioregion is sustainable if it is self-propagating, if it can sustain the life and the community of life that makes the process possible. So there is a kind of a whole sustaining community that the bioregion would assure. Secondly, that it's self-nourishing, that there is food within that bioregion for the life that it has to sustain. And that means also you know, that if you, it isn't just, I mean, it is, the human is a part of that, so it also includes agriculture and commerce, our economic, the way we provide for one another in the bioregion. It isn't just, you know, to think biology, but it is all of what humans bring to the enterprise, to the life enterprise of the planet. And there would be, certainly there's interaction in the bioregion. Birds don't just stay in one bioregion. Many, many species go beyond. So it isn't exclusively that, but there are identifiable birds in some bioregions that are not in others. So there are specifics that go with it. A bioregion is self-educating, that the earth has learned how to be vibrant. The desert is a vibrant community of life. It's different from the mountains, but it has learned how to be vibrant with the givens of that bioregion. And it's experiential mode of operation. It tries different ways to be life-giving. The earth has been self-educating, has learned its way to constantly forward life. It's self-governing. Nothing from the outside tells the bioregion how to sustain that life. It governs its own mechanisms. Animals and plants. There are limiters. Every species has another species to limit it. And there is a governance that is integral to the life of the bioregion. Self-healing. That it has its own regenerative powers. If a forest is destroyed by lightning, that bioregion in its own time will restore that bioregion, perhaps not to the same to the same form it was before, but it has its own way of healing from within. And you know, you can as I say this, it sounds so theoretical and all, but it is lived out around us. But for most of us, we kind of closed off from what identifies our own home. And so to move from this kind of exploitative, anthropocentric way to the kind of participative bioregionalism, that we really move, that we shift our consciousness in that direction. And just as a sample, to say, you know, that what I'm saying is not like, it's not something that isn't possible or even within what people are trying to do today. I read about this and I wrote and have begun a correspondence with this man. His name is Ken Lastman, and he told me he's the fourth generation in rural Kansas. He lives in the Kansas River watershed. He put this together, this man. So I open it, and on the very first page, maybe if I stand back just a little bit, if that would make it easy. On the first page, he has, calendar of the year, and he has an overview of what happens in each month of the year in his bioregion. An overview, okay? And then you turn the page, and he describes a little bit of the Kansas River watershed there. Then I open the next page, and here are the prairie wildflowers that are east and central in his watershed. When they begin to emerge in April and May, what are the wildflowers and the cycle that they have in the year of that watershed? You turn the next page, and he has the prairie wildflowers that are in the western part of that watershed and their cycle during the year. You turn the next page, and he has studied the woodland vegetation and its cycle in his watershed. When that happens, what part of the time of the year, what are the different woodland vegetation that emerges in that water cycle. The next thing he has done are the insects, the reptiles, and the amphibian life in that water cycle. The next thing he's done are the mammals. All the animals that live, and when they molt, and when they bear their young, and how they stay through the winter. And here he's got the migratory bats leave in September and October. They leave the bioregion. And on the next one, he's got the seasonal year-round birds of his bioregion. The aquatic life, and finally food from the land in its cycle in his watershed. Now I say this is somebody who's come home. You know, who's really come home. He knows And he's a part of the very earth that nurtures him, and that he nurtures it, I'm sure, with Islam. It's not a one-sided thing. We're part and parcel of the rhythm of the planet. But I take inspiration from that. I say, oh, you know, if even in our own bag, if I even knew even just the birds that come to our feeder, or the you know, and bit by bit, my dream is, you know, hear it, hold it. Wouldn't it be wonderful, you know, to know kind of, and maybe, and you, I shouldn't say that, because you surely do know a lot here, and I don't mean it that way, but it seems to me we could all kind of be challenged by, and he's a part of a movement, so that there are people trying to live that consciously within their bioregions. And the other arm of that is that many times when I think about this and talk about it in a way, it sounds to me very elitist. You know, like, I think it's something like 70-80% of peoples in the industrialized countries live in cities over 100,000. That most of the human community live in cities. It's 50% in the third world, and something like 78 in communities of over 100,000. We're in cities. And in some way, you know, that when I think about Ken, is in a rural community, and that's different. So a piece of this whole thing is within the bioregional movement, there is a stream, they call it the Green City Movement. And that there is a desire and an imagination, a dream of greening the city. That it isn't just people, you know, it isn't just that we have to learn to live within the bioregion, but that our city life also reflects the regions in which we live. So there's a whole component of the bioregional movement that is Green City. And one of there's a very active unit in San Francisco Bay Area. And the man, in fact, the kind of center to learn more about Green City is in San Francisco. And the man who lives, his name is Peter Berg, and he and his wife are really forwarding this whole notion of the greening of the city. And he keeps saying, Green City is a verb. We have to Green City Los Angeles. We have to Green City New York. We have to Green City Chicago. That it is a way of our understanding that, you know, the cement worlds we have built are really non-sustainable into the future. That we have divorced our children in the cities, don't know. They don't know grass. They don't know what a tree is. Any animal life is to be killed. They're termites or insects or spiders or cockroaches, or we kill them, and that's all they know. And that's not sustainable into the future. So what are you know, what's like between here and there, a dream, what are our ways that the Green City Movement is talking? And they're saying, like, within the city, that peoples are coming together to say, how can we begin greening the city? And that the urban reality would be differentiated because of the bioregion, that it would look differently in San Francisco from Kansas City. You know, you can cross the United States and you don't know what city you're in. You know, it's a Wendy's and a McDonald's and a Sears and a Montgomery Ward, and you know, and you don't know if you're in New York or you're in the middle of the you know, and that is unnatural. Really, it is not a natural growth out of the way the earth grows. You know, you were saying, I mean, we were talking before about people coming to Holden from Chicago. It's just a different reality. And Holden, you know, I mean, the Cascade Mountains are have their own beauty to add to, and that's how we know who God is and what life is about. But if we're all smeared the same, You know, we've lost any kind of sense of the diversity, the richness, the extravagance that's there in nature. So, the whole theory behind Green City, I don't want to spend a lot of time on it or be too theoretical about it, and I'll certainly leave the notes in if you want to look at it, but just to kind of, I guess it for me, or to say as a part of our time together, that there is a greening, there is a hopeful, there is hope bursting forth in many different expressions. And I think the bioregional movement and the green movement. The green movement, in a way, is a parallel political movement that is trying to say that if in fact we are going to shift our institutions, we have to move the body politic to think and act in these ways. And the green movement, if you would say, what are values that you want the church to enhance? Just listen to this. This is the platform of the green movement. Ecological wisdom, grassroots democracy, that people participate in shaping the future of their lives. And that's a Christian social value. Personal and social responsibility. Nonviolence, decentralization. Decisions are made as close as possible to the group of people that has to live with them. Community-based economics, post-patriarchal values, that's an awkward expression, but feminist values, respect for diversity, global responsibility, and a focus on the future, on sustainable, on how it can be moved into the future. So I guess I just lay my case that the bioregional movement and the green movement together offer us something of a sense that that what we are experiencing individually and struggling in our churches or in our own lives, we are part of a community, and that the people are beginning to shape that movement in alternative ways.
She rests her case.
I rest my case.
Robert?
Gosh. I didn't bring a bioregion. I don't know why I'm actually sitting up here, because when the program for the weekend came out and it said forum on Saturday night, it said Jan and R. Robert, and I've been reading it as R up until very recently, and I usually just kind of sit along with Jan and agree with what she says. But
that's usually very fine.
One of the reasons that we were going to be part of this program this weekend, not necessarily the forum, was that we had just a couple of weeks ago gone to an Earth and Spirit conference run by the Chinook Learning Center in Seattle. And I don't want to get into the whole of that conference or anything, but in meeting or being part of a conference that was 1,000 people, over 1,000 people, from all over the United States, from 31 different states and from various other countries in the world, and being able to listen to name people connecting with the environment for 20, 30 years, like Thomas Berry, Joanna Macy, Brian Schwimm, etc., etc. It was really very exciting, but one of the things that I got out of the conference, I think, was hope. And I think the hope is based on the fact that there were a number, so many people there, and who all had the same desire and wish. And I think one of the things that meant most to me at the conference was the despair and empowerment workshop that we went to over 2 days with Joanne and Macy. Mm-hmm. And it was through working through my own despair in the environment of where we're at and how impossible everything seems to be. And in sharing that despair with other people at this workshop, 68 of them, that I think that's one of the places I got a lot of the hope to see that there are other people and that we all feel this way. Now to get to the, and incidentally, Al's changed the topic of the forum a couple of times on it. So the topic now is what am I called to do? And just tell you part of my own story, our own story with regards to that. And I don't have any answers. I agree entirely with what Al was saying this morning, and I think I've agreed with it for years, although I've never verbalized it, and that is that there is something very wrong with our economic system, something wrong with our political system, something wrong with our religious system, something wrong with our social system, that they're totally wrong. So what I see myself to be called to do is not be part of that system or any of these systems, which is easier said than done, because I found in my career as accounting that I definitely was part. I think I realized this 20-30 years ago, but as an accountant I've always been part of the system. I think that ties in with my faith as a Christian, because I don't think Jesus was part of the system in his day. I think he very deliberately set out not to be part of that system. So that's not very encouraging for what happens to people who decide not to be part of the system. But certainly at the moment, the way and how we came to Holden was, I think we decided we didn't want to be part of the system years ago, and we came to Holden, we decided in 1982-83 that it would be really neat to come to Holden, because we'd never succeeded in living a simplified lifestyle. Bits and pieces, yes, but nothing terribly substantial or satisfactory to me. And we didn't seem to be able, or I didn't seem to be able to do it as part of the system. And I thought the opportunity to go to Holden, where it is a simplified lifestyle, would give us a chance to, would give me a chance to think about it and perhaps receive a call, or something will be revealed as to what the next step is. And at this stage I do know that I don't want to go back into the system. I don't want to be part of it. I think we're really lucky, or at least I'm really lucky, we don't have a whole lot of encumbrances left. We don't have a house, we don't have money, we don't have anything like that. So we're, that's quite good, you know, it's really quite lucky. Because I sometimes look at the young people here at Holden and think how great it is. They've just come from college and they can afford an ice cream every couple of times and that's it, you know. I think that's really neat, and they're going out from here. And they don't have anything, they don't have anything to worry about. Because one worries about houses and things.
Children.
Now that's another thing. I think it's impossible to lead an alternative lifestyle with children. Just impossible. So, but luckily, that's another lucky thing. They're just about going on to college. Mm-hmm.
Right. You're being real encouraging today, isn't
it? Sorry about that, David. And that's kind of where I'm at, right? One thing, talking about bioregions and everything, I hope. I think our system, the total system as we understand it today, will have to collapse. Totally. And I pray constantly for the collapse of our economic system, and I think there are glimmerings that it's going to. And maybe out of that, bioregions will come. I cannot see our present system, our present administration, suddenly putting forth a political platform that they'd like to establish bioregions all over the place. I'd love it to come. But one of the things I do want to do, one of the things we're considering when we leave Holden, is trying to find a community that we can live in, and I don't know whether such a community exists, but it would be a community that is spiritually based, and is self-sustaining as much as possible and has some outreach attached to it. And that's where I'm at the moment. I've never been a great one for setting goals, so I have no idea what I'm doing next year, let alone next week. Okay.
Well, I'll try to talk fast. This is a very personal statement, so for what it's worth, here it is. This morning in a conversation with David, I was reminded of a quote that I had found interesting, related to the Last Temptation of Christ, and then that led me on to thinking about another film, The Year of Living Dangerously. You'll be already able to tell that arts play a very large part of my life and is what informs me, even if that art is only found in films. Anyway, that quote is this. The multitudes come to John the Baptist. He said, therefore, to the multitudes that came out to be baptized by him, "You brood of vipers, who warned you to flee the wrath to come? Bear fruits that befit repentance. Even now the axe is laid to the root of the trees. Every tree, therefore, that does not bear good fruit is cut down and thrown into the fire." And the multitude asked him, "What then shall we do?" And he answered them, "He who has two coats, let him share with him who has none, and he who has food, let him do likewise." All of you will know, who've been here very long, that I was raised in a fundamentalist home, and we read the Bible every night, and I heard phrases like that, and as my father was a preacher, I heard them with great force many times. I was always alarmingly, even as a small child, aware of the discrepancy between what we said and what we did. Phrases like that in the Sermon on the Mount in the New Testament, I was just constantly aware of, we don't do that. We're not giving away one of our coats. You know, I was just constantly aware of this discrepancy between what we said and what we did. For many years, I couldn't call myself a Christian. I discovered the Lutheran Church as an adult, and it gave me permission to call myself a Christian, what with, you know, saved by grace and all that, and it wasn't a matter of works. I've heard of Presbyterian pastor who described himself as a confessing and part-time practicing Christian. I found that very comforting. It certainly described where I was at, and it was nice to be able to call myself a Christian with it, and at the same time know that I wasn't doing what it said here, you know? I mean, I just didn't do it. Recently, I heard a comedian who I think put it very nicely, Emo Williams, whose persona as a comedian as a child, some of you may be familiar with him, who said that for years he had prayed for God to give him a bicycle, and then he realized he was doing it all wrong. So he just stole the bicycle and asked for forgiveness. And I think that's an excellent description, not only of a large part of the theology that most of us have been raised with, but certainly the way that our society, our American, our Western society is behaving. Steal the bicycle and then ask for forgiveness. The trouble with all of this is that I may know what's right. I still don't want to do it. And I don't even want to do it. And where does that leave me? We'll go out from Holden in a month's time for an out, and we'll get in the car and drive to Seattle. This morning as I listened to Jane talk, I thought, I shouldn't be getting in the car and driving to Seattle. What Al was saying, a friend the other week in Seattle that we were staying with said that somebody had the audacity to say to her that a certain thing she did in her consumptive lifestyle was the equivalent of X number of lives being lost in a third world country. They put it that piece of consumerism is directly equated to you killed X number of babies last week. And she was offended. And I think we are offended to hear things like that, but it's the truth. But I will get in that car and I will put that that CO2 into the atmosphere and
we'll cancel me out.
I went to this Joanna Macy thing that Robert described as well, and it was
a very profound experience, but most of the time I had to admit that I was as busy protecting myself from those feelings as I was experiencing them. One has a feeling if you let that in, that you wouldn't be able to go on. And that's how I feel. At the same time, I know that we have to experience the pain. We have to be able to experience the pain in some kind of acceptable dose. And I will continue to do that in my life through my great loves, drama, poetry, and dogs. And when we're talking about greening the city, ask me sometime outside of this forum my ideas on companion animals and the greening of the city, and I will tell you at length about them. However, I won't do it now. So when we, at the very least, I feel that what I am called to do, what then shall I do, is to find out what my share of the pie is and try to live within that share of the pie. It's not easy to even find out, but I think we're called on to at least find that out and to try to live within that. As Robert said, if anybody knows of one, let us know of a place that we can go and live out these values, a community that is genuinely trying to live out these values in the green movement, in the bioregional movement. It would be wonderful to know of something like that and to live and enter into that. As Robert said, though, that needs to involve action beyond that, social action, redressing some of the ills that we've already been responsible to create. We can't just withdraw and live in a comfortable community and say, my conscience is clear. We are also called to redress the ills that we have helped create and that we see being created around us, even if we haven't created them. We are called upon to address themselves. I sit in the Resource Center week after week, and all this stuff comes into the mail, and I look at it, and I put it in its category, and I get totally fragmented. There is so much. Where does one start? How does one not get just pulled in all directions? In deference to the original title of this session, I will say that one of the encouraging things that came across my desk within the last year is a movement that is afoot that is underwritten by a number of church leaders in America around the Kairos documents, the Episcopal, the Lutheran, the Catholic. Jim Wallace of the Sojourners Movement, and a number of other people are subscribing to this, calling upon American Christians to read the Kairos documents that have come out of developing countries and to begin to consider what the Kairos moment is in this place, in this time, for Americans who profess to be Christians. They hope to bring this together in the magic year of 1992 and to have a focus. And they're setting up committees of correspondence, just the same as the Green Movement is doing. Mm-hmm. Committees of correspondence of people who are willing to study these documents in groups as individuals and to respond to them. I have the address in the Resource Center for that, if anyone wants to come in and find out about that, and I will give you the address of who to get in touch. There is one thing we can do. So.
Well, I have six things that I might do, six directions. One would be to nurture by word and sacrament, ritual, dance, music, poetry, creation, a creation-centered spirituality. In other words, actually to do the kind of thing that the church does now, for the most part, is to foster a kind of spirituality in the abstraction a good deal, but a way of looking at the world and a little way of looking at Christ and a way of looking at God that creates a certain kind of a perspective. And I think the Canticle of the Cosmos, that 12-part video series we're supposed to be getting soon, probably would move in that direction, so I could spend my time simply taking that canticle everywhere I could and introducing wherever I could. Second thing would be to continue listening to the cry of creation, what I've been doing for 14 months. Read, write, reflect, try try to figure out what's the root problem. You heard where I am at present, where I am today, where I'll be tomorrow, who knows. That's a temporary, I think, short-term program. It's to finish out the year here until June is probably enough on that at most. Third, I could involve myself in education. What is happening to the creation? So I could take all the data that I've been collecting and all my transparencies and just really work at educating either people generally or the church specifically about what it is that's happening. And I think Race to Save the Planet is a good description of what I would be about, and that'd be one of the instruments. It's a reformist position that you can develop a sustainable technology, and there are all kinds of movements in changing that would move in that direction. The fourth, I could get involved in political action. I could actually organize with the Green Movement, I think, a movement of consumers to withdraw their purchasing power from corporate life, from all kinds of institutions, their support for all kinds of institutions, if they didn't forward a certain agreed upon program of ecological responsibility, which we'd have to work out. And there are all kinds of places where you could get directions to move, and some of the things are obvious. Fifth thing that I might do is to work toward an eschatological community. And if I were just about 10 years younger, I would try to move in that direction, although with my family, I've already taken Sarah into one intentional community against her will, and I'm not sure that I could, at my age, do that again. But I would say that, generally speaking, that's a mighty attractive, I would actually try to form this 2500. I mean, I would take on anything practically, as you can see. And I think I could pull it off in about 10 years. That's a little long, but it's an eschatological community. It's not meant to be relevant to the ongoing life. It's meant to be a community that's relevant for the future. It's relevant for what I call God's future. And the sixth thing I could do is to cut my expenditures by two-thirds. In other words, to do what I think we have to do. A simple formula, you see, is say cut your expenditures by two-thirds. Everything you expend destroys the creation. It doesn't tell you what to do, but it gives you a direction and a formula. So you think every time you expend anything. It's very tough, particularly with a bookstore here. that's really a Jonah for me. And then I would move toward getting resources close to where I live. At the same time, there are a couple of little things that where you simply would be aware of what you were buying and try to get your resources and try to move toward growing your own stuff and getting resources. But well, there are six things. And I think it's up for grabs as to where I go. But one of those six, I promise you, I will take. So with that, where, to what are some of you called? You can see these are very personal statements, and they're not meant to be completely thought out or sophisticated, but 4 years. Who has a confession to make?
I was thinking you would take at least 5 of those 6.
All 5 of them. I will wish I were at least 3 people, to tell you the truth. But that's not unusual for me.
For some years after being a student and consuming so much knowledge, I had the opportunity to live in a much more simplified manner in a different culture, and did and enjoyed that, and didn't have as many things in my home, furniture, bed, even not that many books at that time, and then coming back into seminary and being a student again, I feel like I'm consuming so much from the past 4 or 5 years when I was also involved in education but lived a very much more simplistic lifestyle, and I struggle with what it means to be a student again in this culture, what it means to be in America, what you have to do to get around, that you need a car really bothers me. pressures that I feel from different communities that I'm a part of, mm-hmm. and a kind of a sense of longing to go back to some more of a simple lifestyle that I haven't experienced in this country yet, living on my own, that I did experience in Japan.
Where was it that you experienced this?
Japan. It's a struggle to know what to do without, and yet there's a sense of, I have a sense of needing to prepare myself to be a resource person for others also. Mm-hmm. And where do you draw the line? How many books do you really need? There's a real weakness for that.
I keep thinking of the story of Lincoln, that he had Blackstone's Laws, the Bible, and Shakespeare.
Yeah, but I like all the commentary to go with that. People's ideas.
You've probably heard the railroad creek kind of rushing a lot today after all the rains. The image of the creek has, from the years that I've lived here, has often been helpful for me in thinking what, just in remembering what it is like for me to live down lake. I feel like someone would probably feel standing in Railroad Creek right now, that there's all these forces that are kind of constantly coming at you, and slow, you know, a big boulder that's in the creek is eventually going to get worn away by this just steady barrage of water. Mm-hmm. It's tough. You know, got to line up a couple boulders behind each other. You know, I mean, that's the sense of community, that, you know, it's hard to stand alone.
Yeah, that's when we were thinking earlier on along the confessing church lines, and, you know, this question of should we be a confessing church, and if you can't take the institutional church with you, do you step outside it? You know, and asking that question, I don't want to do that. We need each other. And this worshiping together is so important. And to be divisive and to separate ourselves from one another. I mean, that's where we got into the trouble anyway. We separated ourselves from the rest of the world as a species. And, you know, it's... That is so important, that community aspect.
Now, I go back to that point, though, that I do think it's valid, you know, to say that we play different roles. And for some people, the role is no to what is.
Mm-hmm.
Others, it's remedial within the system.
Mm-hmm.
But I think a third group is called to create the vision, to live in the mm-hmm. alternative, and that sometimes means, you know, separation yeah. from what was. But it's mm-hmm. it's not just to separate. The purpose of it is for greater life.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, I mean, I at least my attraction is there. You know, to try and to create and envision.
Jane, what do you consider your calling? I certainly think you have a clear calling. How do you articulate it?
Well, I don't know. It's no clearer, I don't imagine, than any of yours. But, you know, I really made, I can say that I was working at this Justice and Peace Center in Washington. I made a workshop with Thomas Berry 7-8 years ago, and when I heard him, something inside me turned, and I just said, I've got to be about that for the rest of my life. And then it didn't happen immediately. It was 3 or 4 years, you know, before, and then just this little center, and I'm trying, you know, within that framework to, but I think with all of it, the ambiguities and the lack of integration, like you speak something, but I don't live it. I live it, you know, that much. But I suppose there are people who could say very radically, you know, I will be here, and not, and mine is, that's the direction, and I hope that I'm being faithful towards that. But I'm, you know, I'm walking that murky road that's in between. But I am terribly convinced of the vision. I really am, and I you know, like,
and I'm terribly glad that you share that vision. And I say that as a kind of preface for this next little bit. How interconnected and complicated all these problems can get. I remember kind of snickering to myself a little bit a week or so ago when Al talked about what was going to be happening this weekend and was kind of introducing you to us, kind of describing what you did, and I found it somewhat ironic that Al used the phrase that you jetted around the country talking about this stuff, and that, you know, I mean, that is such an ironic combination.
Absolutely.
You know, I remember hearing Larry Rasmussen once say that he refused a speaking engagement at one point because he just thought, with what this particular conference was about, it was totally ludicrous for him to fly from New York City to Los Angeles to, you know, to speak about that. But you know, there's no guiltless place for any of us to stand. We all are kind of caught up in this web, and we have to do what we can. But
absolutely. But I think it is a difference if what we do is in light of what we believe, is in light of a vision.
Absolutely. Yeah.
And then the ambiguity is there, but it, at least, you know, so I justify coming here in light of something, but it's not just, you know.
That's the way I justify buying a book.
Yeah, right.
That's the way I would justify owning a dog.
We've used that word justify a lot.
Jane, the airplane was flying on a route anyway.
But it only flies because people support it.
I'm told it takes more gas to fly than to drive. I don't know whether that's true. I always thought the opposite, but I read that the other day.
Well,
of course, it takes
this,
all your time to do.
Immense weight taken off the ground. You can think it must take even power to do it.
We left a home that we've been in for 30-some years, along with a barn, for pack rats. It's hard to leave because it took so much time to get it out, and come here with so little. And the contrast of what we came with and what we thought we had still haunts me. And I realized that Holden is going to do something very different to us. But then you talk about your books. I left all my books at home because I knew they had a great library. But you know, I still miss my books.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't realize how much a part of me the books were.
Mm-hmm.
And I get lonely for them. I just miss seeing them laying there, mm-hmm. which is silly. You know, the book is useless. Laying there, but I look at it with love and affection.
Mm-hmm.
Can't understand this.
Well, I have started using the Wenatchee Loan Library, and they've got almost anything. It sometimes takes a month to get it, but
I like to write in my book. And then I go back and I look at them later and see my growth, and it tells me something. Mm-hmm. But I do feel guilty about.
Well, we've gone a while. I don't know whether somebody else wants to talk now or wants to talk. We'll have some more time on the last day, certainly, to continue this subject. I would think that somehow or other, each one of us, by the time we're ready to leave, would be able to put on a piece of paper something that we've decided to do. Some little thing we've decided to do. I'm not suggesting any legalism here. Lord knows I'm not a legalist. I've lived this 12 years in this community. You really are thankful for what you get, and don't dwell on what you don't get. Or we tell our stories in our community. I don't think Sarah ever told a story, our life story, kind of to each other. It's a good kind of community building event. So, I mean, anyway, what do you want to do? Do you want to stop now? Do you want to pick this up on the last day when we're kind of, you know, saying what's all this meant and what are we kind of covenanting with each other? I hope we have a kind of covenant with each other to do some things.
You're going to do the church, the parish, tomorrow morning.
And I've got a few materials here in case you should all have the piece on nurturing the body of Christ, a care for the creation task force. And you should have that thing on 128 things to do as a background, because all those things to do are things that you can think about in your parish or in your school or in your own personal life. I think a very interesting thing would be for all of us to write out what we're going to do personally. What we're going to do personally. What we are doing and what we would propose to do. I just think there's scads of personal things to do. Unless you can become a kind of revolutionist and say it isn't worth doing any of those. I'm going off in the desert and sit on top of a stone. Which I don't think is where any of us is, but sometimes I'm almost there. You know, in some ways, it might be better to say no, really say no, than to continue existing in all the ambiguities one has to do. That's impossible with my family. There was value, Jane, in the Catholic orders. There really was. I mean, we're right at the same period of the Middle Ages, I think, where people were really faced with how do you move the culture forward? How do you know what love means in the society in which we exist? And what can we do to preserve some measure of responsibility to God and the creation? So they went off and preserved learning some places, in the face of the barbarians that invaded Rome. And there's a sense in which we're in a very barbarous, I think, a very barbarous period of history in terms of its destructiveness and effect upon the total life of people.